Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument, King v. Kramer. Mr. Devaney.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Devaney. I'm the attorney for the estate of John King. We're asking this court to reverse the grant of summary judgment in this matter because there are material facts in dispute which the trial court did not appreciate. At 6 o'clock on April 18th, 2007, Nurse Anderson claims to have been monitoring John King in a cell in isolation.
How old was he?
John King was 59, Judge.
59. Odd the brief didn't mention his age.
I'm sorry, Judge. He was 49 years old.
49?
Correct myself.
So before you get too deeply into this, I think what I would find useful is particular attention to each of the defendants, because it seems to me they may not be similarly situated with respect to your theory. So, for example, Nurse Mondry Anderson had received a report from Nurse Kramer about Mr. King's condition, and that would be the normal procedure, I would assume, as one shift ends and another shift begins. And so I'm curious as to your theory of deliberate indifference against Mondry Anderson, for example.
Thank you, Judge. Nurse Anderson's medical progress note at 1600 claims that she was monitoring John King through a surveillance monitor and that he was fine. He had been ambulating.
By this time, he's in the padded cell, right?
He is in the padded cell. And he's on a videotape, Judge. And on the videotape, he is dead at that time. He is laying face down.
Not at 1600, he is, and he died. That's 4 o'clock.
I'm sorry. It's 1800.
Right? Yeah.
The medical progress note is 1800. He is lying face down in a toilet grate. He's dead. And he had been seizing for approximately 20 minutes leading up to that. So he was not ambulating correctly. And there is a factual dispute that the video directly addresses, and a jury could infer from it that Nurse Anderson had falsified that information.
But did she see? I thought that she took over from Nurse Kramer and then went across the street and gave the women detainees their medications and then came back.
There is some confusion about that, but her nursing note is clearly at 1800 and claims that he is resting in the cell or lying down when he is dead. And
but does that tell us she's deliberately indifferent, or does that just say she misinterpreted what she was seeing?
Well, that it's a part of the circumstantial evidence, Your Honor. Also, Judge, is the fact that she was made aware of Nurse Kramer's nursing notes, which had a dramatic symptom presentation contained in it. This is a man who has fallen face first to the floor, was trembling, seizing for approximately 30 minutes when Nurse Kramer first saw him, and she wrote that in her note. His pulse rate was 132. That's a runner's pulse rate. It was racing. He was non-responsive, according to our experts, unconscious more likely than not.
And those facts, it seemed to me, may be very significant vis-a-vis Nurse Kramer. Can you just clarify, by the way, one point? I understand from the record that at booking, he does state, among other things, that he suffers from asthma, heart problems, high blood pressure, and seizures. So seizures are mentioned in the booking note?
Yes, Judge. Okay. They are. Although, candidly, there's nothing in this record that would suggest that he had epilepsy. He had complained of seizures, but he is not an epileptic.
Well, epilepsy doesn't exhaust the reasons why somebody might have seizures, of course, but yeah.
Why didn't you sue Dr. Cullinan for malpractice?
At the time that we commenced the suit, I did not fully appreciate the circumstances. We later asked to name HPL, but were denied that opportunity, Your Honor.
What?
We later sought leave to amend the complaint to name HPL, Health Professionals
Limited.
The company,
Limited. Yeah, of which Dr. Cullinan is president.
Yeah, I'm not talking about this suit. Why didn't you sue Cullinan for malpractice in state court?
I don't have an answer for that. I don't do medical malpractice claims.
I don't understand. I don't do medical malpractice. If you have a client who's been a victim of medical malpractice, what do? You just bring constitutional cases or what?
No, Judge, I don't. It's not just that.
This is a malpractice case. Now, maybe there's a constitutional dimension, but basically it's a malpractice case.
I think
so the question is, why isn't there a malpractice suit?
I don't think the two should be mutually exclusive. What we were dealing with was because Dr. Cullinan was in Peoria, Illinois, and the nurses did not tell him what was going on with his patient.
Look, the problem, it seems to me, or a problem or an obvious basis for a malpractice suit is that he directed a very dramatic reduction in the Xanax, whatever it is, that he was taking, this tranquilizer, which apparently was very dangerous, right? That's the key error. Everything seems to follow from that, or much seems to follow from that. So I don't understand why there isn't a malpractice. I don't understand why lawyers leap from a straightforward malpractice claim into a very difficult to win constitutional claim.
I don't have a good answer for that.
It serves the client well, right?
Judge,
why isn't there a malpractice claim?
The last thing that happened on April 18th was the opportunity for the jailers and nurses following procedure and protocol to save his life.
If you have a medical personnel who botch a situation, then you have a malpractice suit. Maybe you have other suits also, and against guards. I guess you couldn't sue a guard for medical malpractice. But, but I don't understand why not the straightforward, you know, state law tort claim. Don't get it.
So I have a question about Dr. Cullinan, which is whether he's licensed to practice medicine in Wisconsin.
I believe that he is, Your Honor.
So
Judge.
So he certainly could have been. I mean, you know, it's a little shocking to think that this company, this maybe takes us to the claim that you have against La Crosse County, is having a doctor in Peoria serve people in La Crosse, Wisconsin. How many miles separate those two cities?
Well, a good 800, I would assume, Judge.
Yeah, so he's obviously not dispensing advice with any information.
If I may, Judge, part of the problem here is that they didn't get the nurses and jailers, didn't get the information to the doctor who could have intervened and seen that a doctor was called for his seizures. Nurse Kramer tells us she knows that the typical triad of symptoms after withdrawal from benzodiazepines is delusion, seizure, and death.
Malpractice. A lot easier to win a malpractice case than a constitutional case.
If I may, Judge, part of the problem here is that they ignored Mr. King, the jailers and the nurses, and they did it because they were annoyed with him. I think that's the tone that comes clear. When Kramer indicates his color is good in her nursing note, we have three nursing students who say he was turning blue, and they were telling her he was turning blue. And she ignored that fact, and she didn't write that in her nursing note. She didn't even take his vital signs, which their own protocol calls for. So they admitted him and put him into an isolation cell, which in order to put him in that infirmary cell, they're supposed to have an admitting note from a doctor. They never contacted a doctor. And when the guards approached, found him like this for the second seizure episode at 11:30, the first words out of Jailer Olson's mouth were, "That's it. I've had it with you. We've got places for people like you." And they put him into an isolation cell, and they did it with an order not to monitor him. And they left him there, and he went into seizures for the third time that day, and he died. And they left him there for an hour and 40 minutes before a guard walked in and kicked him to see if he was alive. They had literally ignored a man who was in acute medical distress. And they knew that the only opportunity for medical care in that jail was an emergency room or a phone call at least to the doctor who had taken him off the alprazolam, who may have recognized the symptoms. His alprazolam was in the same room the nurses were in. He had 115 pills there, and they just didn't give it to him. So I think collectively all of these people contributed, but on that day, on April 18th, it was an acute circumstance that they could have addressed. And I'll say
isn't
this.
Isn't there a conflict in the evidence about whether he responded to the smelling salts, too?
There is, Judge. The nursing students say he did not, and Dad told them that he was unconscious. Nurse Kramer says he did not respond, so there's no conflict. She reads into that that he that means he was faking. And really, that is what this boils down to in a deliberate indifference sense. They were betting on a faking scenario. They were gambling with this man's life. It may be that he could have faked some of those symptoms, but he could not have faked all of those symptoms. And this is a man who
what would you regard as a key error in Judge Conley's opinion?
I believe the key error is his assessment that Nurse Kramer's betting on a faking scenario was the exercise of professional judgment, and that it was something that the guards were entitled to defer to because they had reason to believe that deferral wasn't warranted.
Oh, no, but again, we're back talking about negligence or, you know, and malpractice. Yeah, she may have made a very serious mistake. That's not the same thing as deliberate indifference.
Isn't there testimony that she said she knew she needed to ask a doctor to analyze these seizure symptoms?
Their protocol requires her in every seizure to call the doctor on call. And there
so
is an
to
assessment
take it upon herself, I thought your theory wasn't the exercise of medical judgment. It was refusing to get the only capable person who could assess.
That is our theory, Judge. And it's because the nurse's training, which we put in the briefs, it doesn't allow them to make these decisions. And Nurse Kramer herself has admitted, I can't diagnose a seizure. Only a doctor can do that.
But where is the deliberate indifference as distinct? What's the line between negligence and deliberate indifference? Gross negligence, right, is not deliberate indifference. So what is the line?
Deliberate indifference in this case setting, Judge, is when the man is punished for the display of his symptoms.
That's not a responsive. They didn't think they were killing him. Now, where's the line between gross negligence and deliberate indifference?
It's a mental state, and there's a factual dispute about it, and I believe that's what requires a trial in this case. There are
a mental state? I don't know if it's a mental state.
No, but I thought your theory was it becomes deliberate indifference when she does something she's not supposed to be doing and not trained to be doing. It's not her medical judgment. She's not calling the doctor.
That is exactly my position.
But that was not deliberate indifference. That's negligence. Right.
I would argue
that. Well, it could be deliberate.
Judge,
deliberate indifference usually means you're conscious, the way the courts define it, you're conscious of a high risk, and you make a judgment to ignore it. Right. Now, if you don't think there's a risk, if you honestly think this person is faking, then you're not deliberately indifferent.
I would disagree in one respect, Judge. If
she didn't think he was faking and just said it because she didn't like him, or what?
I think that she staked out her position when she walked down the hallway with the nursing students and said, he's probably faking.
Well, okay, but if she really believed he's probably faking, that's not deliberate indifference. That's a mistake.
I understand Farmer versus Brennan to say it doesn't matter whether they believed. If they were aware of the risk of harm, and there is a template for them to have assessed that risk in their own protocols and training, the jailers, as I pointed out, are trained that they are to treat all seizures as a medical emergency.
If you were convinced a person was faking, then you would ignore the person, wouldn't you? I mean, it might be a serious mistake, but why would that be deliberate indifference?
I don't think that medical personnel, a nurse in this case, and the jailers in this setting can just ignore him. He can't get help anywhere else. And he is non-responsive. There's no words coming out of his mouth. No one knows the seriousness.
It's very common for doctors to say to patients, look, there's nothing wrong with you, you know. Forget about it. And then the person drops dead a minute later, right? I mean, sometimes it's not even negligence, but often it would be negligence. But why would it be deliberate indifference?
Because, Judge, respectfully, because they didn't call the doctor. If the doctor had made that decision, it would be negligence, but he never got that chance. They just decided on their own they were not going to follow their procedures and not obtain the information or the access to a doctor. They denied him the help that would have saved his life. And we have testimony to say that more likely than not, if he had been taken to an emergency room, he would have survived this. So that...
Okay, thank you. Well, your time has expired, but I'll give
thank you,
a minute later. Ms. Doyle?
What?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Sullivan. Sorry.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, and Mr. Devaney. My name is Pat Sullivan, and I represent the nurses, the appellees, Sue Kramer and Karen Mondre Anderson. And I agree with you, Judge. I believe the point that you are making here is that this case...
Well, why don't you respond directly to Mr. Devaney's last point. That's his strongest point, right? He says they're supposed to follow certain procedures. They deliberately refuse. They know there's some risk. They can't be certain he's faking. So why doesn't that add up to deliberate indifference?
Because, Your Honor, in this Seventh Circuit, and as the U.S. Supreme Court has told us,
it's just a direct answer. Huh?
The standard of deliberate indifference requires that Nurse Kramer, in this case, actually believed Mr. King was seizing, having seizures.
Not really. She could have been reckless. I mean, if you look at the language of Farmer versus Brennan, which is what we are obliged to follow, she could as well have been reckless. And the evidence is conflicting about what she found, the evidence about the smelling salts, the evidence whether a person is actually capable of holding his breath long enough to turn blue. I don't know if you've ever tried to stop the hiccups by holding your breath, but you probably don't turn blue because your autonomic nervous system takes over and you're going to start breathing again. So there's evidence in this record to suggest that in the face of powerful signals that a doctor needed to be called, she just didn't want to do it.
Your Honor, I think the cases that you're referring to also tell us we have to look at the totality of the medical care that was provided.
No, I mean, I'm looking at her role in particular. I'm not talking, I mean, obviously your colleague will discuss the jailers in the county, and I think the point that you make that Nurse Anderson is in a different position is a serious point. But Kramer is looking, she's the person in charge, and she's looking at these symptoms and taking it upon herself to disregard the protocols.
Your Honor, there's no evidence that she took it upon herself to disregard
protocols. Yes, she did. She didn't. She's the one who could have picked up the phone and called this man 800 miles away in Peoria to see what's up.
Judge, actually, there's a doctor in La Crosse, Dr. Erickson, who saw Mr. King the day before.
Right, when he wasn't seizing. Now, she doesn't call Dr. Erickson either, unfortunately.
She does not, in part because of what Dr. Erickson concluded in his exam of the gentleman the day before.
Why does that have anything to do with it?
Because there's no history of seizure.
No, but he said there was in his intake. That's why I stressed that question at the outset.
Your Honor, he filled out a form where he also checked off that he had cancer, which he didn't have.
Well, and who's going to take the risk that it's wrong? If he's checked that he's had seizures and he's on the floor, foaming at the mouth, not able to respond to smelling salts, which have a disgusting odor that people draw back from, that's rolling the dice pretty seriously, isn't it?
No, Judge, I disagree.
We're
all looking at this in hindsight. I grant you that. And perhaps her decision was wrong, but it was a medical judgment.
Well, her decision was obviously wrong, but looking at it ex ante, then you have to say, well, what did she see at the time? She sees a man who sees.
I'd like to tell you what she saw, Judge. She saw a number of things. She saw things that were inconsistent with seizures.
But
we've
see, here's the problem with that part of your theory. You stress that quite a bit in your brief. But as I'm sure you know, we probably wouldn't need doctors if everybody had symptoms that exactly matched the medical textbooks. So there are going to be situations where 4 out of 6 symptoms are shown, or 3 out of 6, and that would strike me as the reason why the protocol that the jail says that it follows instructs people to contact a physician.
Judge, I would respectfully suggest that the nurses have to have some discretion here. Otherwise, what we're talking about is picking up that phone call every time an inmate demonstrates any symptom that could be consistent with a serious health risk.
What if it's potentially, well, and what is wrong with that? How many people over the course of a year have seizures in this particular jail?
I don't know the number on that, Judge, but in this particular jail?
Two? I mean, you know, is this like pestering the doctors with phone calls?
I can tell you. I can tell you that based on the record.
Be defending the the quality of her judgment or anything like that. Surely, I mean, your argument has to be that she wasn't deliberately indifferent, right? She probably was negligent.
My argument is she made a judgment, Your Honor, and the question that Judge Wood asked
is... She made the wrong judgment, right?
Granted. And the question that Judge Wood asked was, why not just pick up the phone? This only
and particularly since you're just a nurse. You don't have the letters MD after your name, and so you are assuming a diagnostic chore that is not the one that you're supposed to be doing.
You're fulfilling the role of an RN in this particular jail, which is to assess, make decisions about treatment.
You're not making the right argument for your case. It doesn't matter whether she should have picked up the phone. Of course she should have, and her judgment may have been really stupid. The question is, since this is, you know, under cruel and unusual punishment, was she really, you know, indifferent to this fellow's welfare?
And I would love to answer that question, Judge, and here's my answer. She was not, and the evidence is in the totality of the care. Earlier in that morning at 7 a.m., this is the nurse that picks up the phone to call the doctor. Because late in the night, the day previous, his wife had dropped off an inhaler. She calls the doctor to see if it's safe for him to use this inhaler by himself. That's not the act of a deliberately indifferent nurse.
But that's not the incident of deliberate indifference either. I think you need to focus on her behavior with respect to the seizures.
Judge Gutierrez tells us we have to look at the totality of her care.
But nothing that happened before had anything to do with treating the seizures.
It certainly did, Your Honor.
Sleep problems. No, I don't think so at all.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Judge, to the extent that her culpable intent is what is at issue here. Okay.
Right, but don't we have conflicting evidence on that? She's also making cracks to the student nurses that, in retrospect, look fairly callous.
Well, Judge, if we look carefully at what she said some inmates fake seizures. And that's been her experience. It's in the record. She has half a dozen such experiences in her 19 or 18-year career at the jail. She's a nurse who's familiar with what goes on inside the jail. She made the wrong decision, but she based it on her assessment, which included lots of things that contraindicated seizure. She could pick up the phone. She could make the call.
Does she know that seizures caused by withdrawal from benzodiazepines are the same as seizures from epilepsy or the same as seizures from other neural conditions?
She does not.
Okay.
There's no evidence in the record that she was ever asked that question. We don't have that in the record, so we're assuming she does not. But to conclude, if I may, deliberate indifference requires this subjective belief by Nurse Kramer that Mr. King was seizing. There's no evidence that she believed it and then intentionally disregarded that medical need. It's the wrong decision, but it's negligence, perhaps grossly so. And Nurse Anderson is obviously in a much different situation. She never saw any of this alleged seizure behavior. She simply relied on what Kramer told her when she took report at 5 o'clock, and the next time she saw Mr. King, unfortunately, he had passed away.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. Ms. Doyle?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Amy Doyle, and I represent La Crosse County and the two jail officers, Officer Olson and Jennifer Colby Goebel. The two claims that are being made against the county defendants are that the two jail officers were deliberately indifferent to Mr. King's medical needs and that La Crosse County maintained an unconstitutional policy and practice with respect to inadequate medical care, in particular, I think, prescription medications.
I want to talk to you about the county for a minute, because I think I understand your theory with respect to the jail officers to be that they were entitled to rely on medical personnel. But with respect to the county, first of all, they're using this company HPL, whose strategy seems to be to spend as little money as possible on medical care. And they kind of brag in one of these news articles that they've brought costs down 70%, and they're using a doctor in Peoria to help monitor La Crosse County, Wisconsin. And they do seem to have a fairly casual approach toward medications, isn't it? That's a county policy to use HPL, right?
Well, the county did contract with HPL.
But right, so that's a county policy. Now, the question is that a policy that's constitutionally, are they so bad that that's constitutionally offensive?
I guess I would say no. In that contract, not only is Dr. Cullen, and yes, he's in Illinois, but the contract also provided for nurses, registered nurses, LPNs, along with Dr. Erickson, who is located in La Crosse. Dr. Erickson would come in on a weekly basis for, I'm not sure if it's 3 or 4 hours each week, to see inmates. So it was not just we're going to contact an out-of-state doctor, but there was actually a doctor in La Crosse that came in and actually saw the inmates. And in this case, he did see Mr. King the day before he died.
And is there an arrangement with, I remember the answer to this is yes, but is there an arrangement with the local emergency rooms or clinics or anything in
yes,
La Crosse area?
There's also arrangements with the local hospitals. If there is emergency care that is necessary, the inmate would be transported to the emergency room.
And who normally makes that decision? Is that the jailer, or do you have to wait for a nurse to come in? Or?
Well, under La Crosse policy, if a nurse is present and there is a concern about an inmate's care or health issues, the nurse would be contacted. The nurse would then make an evaluation, and if the inmate needed to be transported, the inmate would be. If a nurse is not on duty, that decision can be made by a supervisor or someone else on duty. Mm-hmm. But that is the policy.
How many of these pills was he? Did he have a prescription or did he just have a bunch of pills?
When he was booked at the jail, my understanding is that he had several bottles, several different prescriptions.
115 pills. I'm asking you, did he have a prescription?
For the aprazolam, I believe he did. Yes.
How many was he supposed to take per day?
I believe initially he was taking 3 or 4 a day, and I don't remember the dosage.
That what the prescription said?
Yes.
3 to 4?
I don't represent the nurses, but that is just my recollection. But my understanding is that he brought a big bag of medications when he was booked. They were documented by the nurse, and the jail doctor was consulted, and decisions were made with respect to medications that Mr. King should
but
continue.
If he had a prescription for 3 or 4 a day, what was and the doctor wanted to reduce that to what?
I believe that it was reduced over a 2 or 3 day period, and I'm not sure if it was down to 2 a day and then 1 a day. I don't know the exact timing of it.
If King had this prescription, why would the doctor want to reduce it?
But I think, and again, I don't represent the nurses or the doctors, but I think there are many reasons. As the district court explained, an inmate may come in with several medications from several different doctors.
Well, no, but was there multiple prescriptions, or was there just a prescription for 3 or 4 a day?
I don't believe that there were multiple prescriptions for the aprazolam.
What?
I thought the record showed that they actually checked all of this out with the Toma Veterans Administration Hospital, and that it was not the hypothetical of somebody who doctor shops and comes in with a lot of pills. In fact, the doctors at Toma had prescribed this.
I agree that the doctor did prescribe
it. If he had a prescription for 3 or 4 a day, what would be the basis for your doctor, the company's doctor, reducing it?
And again, I don't represent Dr.
There are problems with reducing dosage of tranquilizers. So what was his basis for doing that?
And that I know that Dr. Cullinan evaluated the medications, and all I can say is that he made decisions on what medications to continue.
Did he speak to the people at the Veterans Hospital and say to them, look, I think he's taking too much of this stuff?
I don't know that. I think the record...
Well, he didn't, and since he hasn't seen this, he hasn't seen King, seems pretty dangerous for him to do this.
Of course,
there apparently is some evidence that this company is very big on cost cutting.
I don't think that there's evidence in the record that Dr. Cullinan, you know, the decisions he made, and he's not being sued, so...
No, that's strange, but still... It is a puzzle. I mean, after all, their theory of the county's liability is that they know that this company is a ruthless cost cutter.
Well, I don't think
care. And what Cullinan did does seem pretty serious malpractice.
See, I don't believe that the county believed or had knowledge, and still does not believe that they were not providing the requisite medical care.
Wait a second. You can't justify that. You can't have someone... You have a drug where reducing the dosage can have serious side effects. You have a doctor who knows this fellow has a prescription from the Veterans Hospital, and he cuts it down drastically. It goes from 3 to 4 a day to... 1 a day, that's a, you know, 2/3 or 3/4 cut, and he does that without calling the Veterans Hospital to ask why this fellow has this large prescription. So that sounds really bad.
I see my time is up. If I could answer
well,
that.
Why would I ask you a question if I didn't want you to answer it?
Okay. I don't believe that there's any evidence in the record that the county maintained an unconstitutional policy or practice with respect to medical care. There's no evidence that the county was aware that Mr. King was not provided with necessary or appropriate medications. And Mr. King is trying to establish a policy and practice based on newspaper articles from 2004 and 2006, which I don't think are admissible. They're inadmissible hearsay, and there's no other evidence that there are other instances where inmates were not provided with appropriate medication. In fact, the evidence in the record is that each time there was a complaint or an issue, that matter was investigated, HPL was contacted, discussions took place, meetings took place as to what was occurring, and you know, possibly changes to make sure that inmates were provided with the necessary medical care.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Doyle. Mr. Devaney, we'll give you another minute or two if you need it.
Thank you, judges. Mr. King's prescription for alprazolam was 3 times daily and 2 at night, so he was receiving 5 pills per day. The reason he was taken off, Nurse Anderson told the investigator who looked into this matter for the sheriff, was because the drug was not on the company's formulary. And that is in the docket entry of Captain Coronado's report, number 76. Judge, I would like to address the question I couldn't answer when you asked it. Where's the line between negligence and deliberate indifference? And suggest this answer. If you're 100% sure that he's faking it, and you make, and you're wrong...
95% sure.
If you, I can't use the percentages, Judge. But if you think he's probably
percentage,
but
right? You said 100%. Now I'm saying what? 95%.
I see your point. Probability is the issue for deliberate indifference, I think. And
right now, so let's talk about probability. Does it have to be 95%, 80%, 50%? What?
Well, if she thinks, she, Kramer, thinks he's probably faking, it has to be drawn from some kind of expertise or experience. It can't just be pure speculation. If she is allowed to speculate outside her training and
experience. According to your opponent, she has 18 years in which she's observed a half dozen incidents of faking. So,
a half a dozen incidents of seizures. There's no connecting the dots as to what happened in those events or anything like that. So we don't know. Maybe she's ignored six people over the years, and luckily this is the first death.
Was she deposed?
She was, Judge.
Did they ask her about these incidents?
No. The nurses argue that there was an assessment performed by Nurse Kramer, but the template for an assessment is in their protocol number 54, and their medical protocols are the standard of care in this case under their own policies.
Yes, standard of care is fine, but I'm baffled why you didn't bring a malpractice suit, especially against Cullinan.
The point I was about to make, Judge, is that they are to assess initially by taking vital signs. That was never done in this case. The one thing they didn't do, because of the force of his tremors, was take his vital signs. Kramer tells Anderson, I couldn't get the vital signs. And Kramer tells us in her deposition she couldn't get into the cell to take the vital signs because the jailers wouldn't let her in. They were always too busy. And that fits with their idea that he's there to punish him. And so Kramer tells Anderson to take the vital signs, and she doesn't. So the vital signs are never taken. That is an assessment. The assessment I submit is not that she stands there and looks at him on the floor, seizing, and decides he's faking. That is just not a logical, rational, or professional process. That is betting on faking, and it's a gamble. And this man's life was at stake. I just would rest on the briefs for the rest.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Devaney, and thank you to Mr. Sullivan and Ms. Doyle.